Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Oh, welcome back into the House of Mystery. And on the line, like we were saying before the break, we've got author Abigail Pesta, who's written the book called The Girls. Thank you for being here, Abigail.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for spreading the word about the brave women in this book. You know, they told their stories to help people recognize the signs of a predator, so these stories need to be heard.
Yeah, and, you know, I was going to say, along that subject line, there's also a mentality in the U.S. right now, and I don't know if this was an issue in this case. It seems like there's a lot of accusations about a lot of assaults, and there's a lot of negative feedback toward it, like they just want money, they're jumping on the bandwagon, and all of that stuff. Even the Supreme Court justice that was going for it, right? There's just so much stuff out there. Was that an issue for a lot of the girls?
Well, for the women in this case, it's always, you know, it takes a lot of courage to come forward and publicly identify yourself as a survivor of sexual abuse. So for every single one of the women in this case who has done so, it takes a lot of courage. Yes, you are, you know, subjecting yourself to blame and shame and accusations, and that's always been a problem for women who come forward with reports of abuse. In this case, in the Larry Nassar case, there is no question that he abused hundreds of young women and girls. He pleaded guilty. He, over time, had taken videos of this abuse, which he disguised as a treatment, and he talked about what he did. You know, he there's just no question that he's guilty. And but even still, that doesn't prevent people from, you know, blaming the women. Mm-hmm. I got very interested in this case in the beginning because, as a journalist, I write about women fighting back against crime and injustice. And I interviewed one of the first women to publicly identify herself as a survivor of Nassar's abuse. And she was a college student, and I sat down with her and her mom, and this was in the early months of the scandal. And they told me how the young woman, her name is Lindsay Lemke, was a kid when Nasser was abusing her, and she didn't realize it was abuse. He was the Olympic doctor at that point, and she was honored that he was making time for her, and he had befriended her and the family and the entire community. But so they had found out that, in fact, you know, he had been abusing Lindsay for years, hundreds of times, and she and her mom were trying to come to grips with this. It was just a terrible realization. This was their trusted doctor and friend. And they said people were blaming them, you know, that on Facebook people would say, why didn't the parents know, or why didn't the kids tell? And I just thought, what a nightmare. Here's this family grappling with this terrible realization, and they're getting blamed for it. You know, so that's when I started to think, let's help people understand how this happened, and then hopefully we can help prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, because I was going to say, his defense attorney, Nasser's defense attorney, you know, what was it, Shannon Smith, and look at look at her comments about how she didn't believe the girls because they were all living a perfectly, what she said, normal life, and never questioned the assault, and always thought of it as a treatment until all this, you know, happened. So with that kind of attitude, you're kind of fighting an uphill battle.
Well, for one thing, Nasser preyed on kids, and a lot of these kids, not all of them, but many of them were gymnasts. Now, a number of them were just kids in the local Lansing, Michigan community, cheerleaders, volleyball players, dancers, runners. He got his hands on all kinds of kids because he was a professor and a doctor at Michigan State University, so he worked in the sports medicine clinic at the university, but he also volunteered at a local gym for gymnasts, and he also rose to become Olympic doctor. But for one thing, he was preying on kids, and a lot of them were very vulnerable kids because they had grown up in gymnastics boot camp. They, especially in this Michigan community, there was a gym run by a coach named John Gettert, where these girls were just, they described just a horror show of being, they called it brain, they said they were brainwashed. They said they got in there as little kids, and this hard-driving coach told them, he blamed them for their injuries. He said injuries were their fault because they weren't concentrating. So kids were really, you know, they were hiding their injuries. They said they were berated and shoved physically, mocked, that the coach made sexual comments, that he walked in on them in the bathroom, in the locker room. So, you know, a lot of these kids in this world had already lost their sense of boundaries and their sense of self, and then they got sent into Nasser's lair, you know, so they were very vulnerable kids. So a lot of them did not realize they were being abused, but some of them did realize it, and for nearly three decades, they reported him. They reported him to coaches and to counselors and to the police. No one listened. No one believed the girls. They just all believed the doctor.
Well, I'm curious. I have to ask this. You said that, Al, you said that the lawyer, Shannon Smith, had doubted that these girls were telling the truth. Isn't there something like over 250 girls who have accused him over the years? That seems unlikely that they'd all be lying about that.
Yeah, I didn't quote the defense attorney as saying.
No, Al did. I was curious.
Yeah. But I did speak to that defense attorney, in fact. So I don't know. I'm not sure where that quote is coming from, but in the end, more than some 500 women have come forward because he got away with this for almost 30 years. So he was getting his hands on kids across his community in Lansing, Michigan. You know, he was getting his hands on kids at the local high school, in addition to the gym, in addition to the Michigan State Clinic, in addition to the U.S. National Gymnastics team and the Olympic team. You know, he was everywhere. He was also, working with gymnasts at the Caroli Ranch in Texas, the Olympic Training Center. So over nearly 30 years, he had a lot of opportunities to abuse kids.
Mm. Yeah, that quote was, she was doing an interview, Shannon Smith, that is, on News Radio 950 WWJ.
Ah, okay.
But,
I did speak with her for the book. She hadn't told me that she doubted the women. But she did tell me something interesting about Nasser, which was, she said in the beginning, he seemed to have some kind of disconnect. Like he would, you know, he would tell her, I'm not penetrating these girls, because he, you know, what he did is he was an osteopath, and he convinced kids that if he would touch them in one part of their body, it would help another part. And so that's how he, you know, made kids think it was okay that he was penetrating them with his bare hands. Oh. And you know, she told me that in the beginning of the case, he was telling her, "I don't penetrate." She actually had videos where he was doing that and talking about that, because that was what he called his treatment. So, you know, I think he was such a master manipulator because he had decades to hone his skills. He was constantly manipulating. And no wonder he got away with it so many times. You know, back in 2004, a teenage girl, Brianne Randall, went to the police with her mother in Meridian Township in Michigan and reported him for sexual abuse. And the police interviewed her and then interviewed him, and that was it. They believed him. The end. Case closed. They didn't interview any other experts to see if the so-called treatment was legitimate. But that was just one of many times that girls reported him. Back in 1997, a teenage girl reported him to the coach at Michigan State University, and she said, that was Larissa Boyce, she said the coach didn't tell her parents, didn't tell any authorities, but told Nasser. And then Larissa got in trouble for doubting the doctor, and she was a kid, and she thought, oh gosh, I must have a dirty mind. And so she wound up back on the doctor's table, and he continued to abuse her for years. You know, over time, there were just a number of these cases where young women and girls did realize they were being abused, and they did report it, and just, you know, got dismissed and disbelieved.
Why do you think they did that? Why do you think when the police were told by, you know, brought in with a mother and a child, and they're saying, you know, this man did this, and then other people, why did they keep on just kind of ignoring it, or just, you know, brushing it under the rug, so to speak?
Well, one thing that was interesting in that case of the police in 2004, that profound failure, that police department ended up apologizing to that young woman and her family after Nasser was sentenced. And they did a public apology and a private apology to her. But I think in answer to your question, you know, that's the big question here. Why don't people listen to young women and girls? Why didn't they for decades? And, you know, there were a number of trainers and coaches at Michigan State who were also told, you know, what Nasser was doing. And the Michigan Attorney General did an investigation of Michigan State after Nasser was sentenced to see what went wrong there. And that report found that more than a dozen young women had talked to coaches or counselors or trainers about Nasser, and no one had done anything. And the Attorney General's report concluded that it wasn't that people were necessarily trying to cover for him, but that they just weren't listening, they weren't paying attention, they weren't believing. He had risen to become such a big deal doctor. He had risen to become the Olympic doctor that everyone thought it was a tremendous honor, you know, that he was working there at the university. And they just thought, oh, well, maybe the girls misunderstood, or, you know, he would never harm anyone. Mm-hmm. So I think that was part of it. But then there was also blatant covering up as well. Michigan State, in 2014, a young woman named Amanda Thomashaw reported him to the police and to Michigan State University after he abused her at the Michigan State Sports Medicine Clinic. And the university issued two reports, one for her that said he had not violated the school's sexual harassment policy, and a second report for the staff members that said, yikes, major red flags here. Legal, you know, potential legal liabilities. You know, in other words, one report for her saying no wrongdoing, an internal report saying, okay, this is, you know, problematic, and we could be under fire legally and let's take a look. So, you know, that was basically covering it up, and they got busted for that. Then a couple years later, both reports came out, but also the police failed to file any charges against Nasser as well. He, you know, he manipulated just everyone around him.
So what broke the case? Like what was the one thing or the one person that people listened to?
So finally, in 2016, the Indianapolis Star newspaper ran a report about USA Gymnastics. That's the governing body for the sport, and it's based in Indianapolis. And they did a report about how the organization was mishandling reports of abuse at the hands of coaches. And after that report came out, a former gymnast named Rachel Den Hollander contacted the paper and said a doctor had abused her, Larry Nasser. And then two other gymnasts, Jessica Howard and Jamie Dancher, also called the paper and said, named Larry Nasser as an abuser. So, you know, so three people contacted the Star. The Star did an investigation, ran a report on Nasser. And the police this time investigated and acted after having failed the prior two times in 2004 and in 2014. And more women started coming forward. So I think part of it was good journalism. Part of it was the bravery of these women who were coming forward. And part of it was that it was 2016 and people were starting to finally listen. I mean, we still have a long way to go, but people were starting to understand and listen when women were reporting sexual assault. So I think all of those factors, you know, finally brought him down as more and more women came forward and spoke to the police. And the police began investigating him, and they found tens of thousands of images of child pornography on his hard drive in the trash. You know, that was the takedown finally. But there were huge failures in the lead up to that too, because a year before the Indianapolis Star report, a coach had overheard two gymnasts talking about Nasser at the Caroli Ranch in Texas, and had told USA Gymnastics about what she had heard. And, you know, the girls were just talking about, you know, what he did and how it felt uncomfortable and weird, and the coach heard this and thought, whoa, that's not right. So she reported the doctor then, and USA Gymnastics suspended him, but lied about the reason why, told gymnasts and their families that, you know, the organization didn't say he was under investigation, but said that he, you know, had personal reasons why he wouldn't be at available at events. And then, you know, they didn't tell the FBI for several weeks. The FBI didn't do anything for a year. The U.S. Olympic Committee did nothing. No one did anything until the Indianapolis Star report came out. So, you know, for more than a year after USA Gymnastics had been alerted, Nasser continued abusing girls at Michigan State, at the gym in Michigan, at the high school in Michigan. You know, it's just outrageous.
How did he get away with it in so many ways? Like, you know, he's doing all of this abuse mm-hmm. throughout all of these places. And even I noticed listening in your book, a lot of times he would do it right in front of the parents.
Yes, and that's what the women in this book really help people understand, how he got away with it for almost 30 years. Because these were, you know, the women in this book grew up with him, from a lot of them from the time they were toddlers. A lot of them are telling their stories for the first time, and they unveil how over the years he transformed himself from a doctor to a predator, starting back in 1988, the very first survivor, Sarah Turisti, who tells her story for the first time in this book. She was there the day Nasser walked into this gym in Michigan to volunteer. He was a medical student at the time. And he started testing limits with her early on. She was trying to come back from a broken sternum and broken ribs. And, you know, she describes how he began pushing her, icing her chest and pushing her leotard down and touching her nipples. And that's, you know, that's really how it all began. He was seeing what he could get away with her. But he wasn't that nice to her at the time. And it's interesting because over time he figured a lot of things out. He figured out how to befriend the kids, how to bring them gifts and compliment them, and how to befriend their parents, and, you know, how to gain everyone's trust. And he ingratiated himself to the coach at this gym, John Gettert. And he plays a central role in this story, too, because Sarah says that the coach actually walked in and saw Nasser abusing her, and that she said she was lying topless on a table. Nasser was icing her chest and touching her nipples, and she said Gettert was there, and that he didn't report the abuse, but instead made fun of her. She said he mocked her breasts. She had a lump on her chest from the rib injury, and she said he called it her third boob. And she said he then began referring to her by the nickname third boob. And she says if he had done something back in the late 80s, you know, decades of abuse could have been stopped. So
Gettert, you know, really played a role in this. I was going to say Gettert and Nasser, the relationship the two of them had contributed to this as well.
Well, that's what so many of the women told me, is that those two men who began working together back in the late 80s, and they rose to Olympic doctor and Olympic coach. Gettert became an Olympic coach. They worked together for nearly 30 years at this gym while Nasser was abusing girls in the back room. And so many of the gymnasts I talked to said that the training environment was so abusive that it really made the girls vulnerable to the sexual abuse. You know, one young woman told me she trained and competed on a broken leg and a broken elbow because she was afraid of getting in trouble for being injured. And she didn't know her bones were broken, but she knew she was in excruciating pain. And she told Nasser, and Nasser just taped her up and said she was fine. And finally, one day at a practice, she simply couldn't do her floor routine on a broken leg. And she said Gettert punished her for that, that he made her do the routine substituting somersaults for the flips in the air. And he gathered all the girls around to humiliate her. And her younger sister was there and had to watch this. And, you know, she said it was mortifying. Her older sister's crying, trying to do the floor routine, doing somersaults. Here, it turns out, she had broken limbs. You know, it's just insane. I heard so many horror stories out of that gym like that. Another young woman told me she had flown off the uneven bars and gotten injured, and she got punished for getting injured. She had to sit in the oversplits, which are splits where you elevate one leg so you go down deeper than the usual splits. That was her punishment for getting injured. And then she said Nasser came along. You know, she said her face was bloody. She was crying. She's sitting in the oversplits in trouble for being injured, and she said Nasser came along and said, oh, let me help you, and then he talked about what a jerk Gettert was, and so Nasser, you know, he learned to gain the gymnast's trust, and then later he cashed in on that, and he abused her. But, yeah, what I was starting to say earlier, too, is over time, the women show how Nasser evolved. He not only figured out how to befriend the girls and their families, how to ingratiate himself to the coach and to authorities and to everyone around him, but he just became a master. He, over time, began bringing kids gifts. When he became Olympic doctor, he'd bring them gifts from the Olympics that reminded them that he was this powerful doctor, and they felt honored to see him. Yes, as you mentioned, another tactic was he would abuse kids with a parent in the room. He would block their view so they couldn't see what was happening. He had figured out that the child was unlikely to say anything because probably, you know, the girl wouldn't realize she was being abused. And if, you know, if her mom or dad was in the room, then she would think, well, it must be okay because my parents are here, you know. And that's just dreadful. I spoke to some of those parents who were in the room when their child was being abused, and they're just devastated. But that was another tactic he learned to use. Once social media came around, he started using that. He would like the girl's Instagram post. He would compliment on their, or Facebook, or, you know, he would text them. He would compliment on them on their outfits, on their wins, on their looks. You know, another tactic he had was he would not bill the family's health insurer. He would say, I see such potential in your child that, you know, I'm going to treat her without billing you. And these are families, you know, the girls were maybe hoping for a college scholarship. These were not wealthy families. The girls weren't necessarily aiming for the Olympics. They were girls in Lansing, Michigan. And the families would think, wow, he's so generous. That's so amazing. He's not going to bill our health insurer. And then they look back today and they realize, oh my God, he didn't bill the insurer, so there were no records. No one could ask, you know, no medical officials could say, wait, what's this person doing? Well, why is he, you know, seeing my daughter so frequently? So all of these tactics, you know, over time, this is what these women really do such an incredible job of showing, you know, how he got away with it. And, yeah, he just constantly evolved.
Mm. And I guess Gettert, the coach, would be really mean to the girls, so it almost sent them to Nassar for comfort in a way too.
Yeah, a lot of the women describe it as like a good cop bad cop situation. You know, Gettert would yell at them and berate them and just trample their self esteem, and then they would be sent to Nassar, and the Nassar would befriend them, and you know, they felt they could confide in him. And this was, you know, young women across the spectrum, the gymnasts at the gym in Michigan, you know, the young dancers and other athletes in Michigan, the Olympic gymnasts, you know, an Olympic gymnast wrote the foreword to the book, and her sister, who was a national team member, Tasha and Jordan Schweikert. And they said too, when they were training, on the national team and the Olympic team at the Caroli Ranch, the coaching there, you know, under the Carolis, was extremely abusive too. And they said that they would go to Nassar's room and he would be their friend, and that was their safe place. And he was nice to them, and you know, he would sneak them secret treats, and which meant like granola bars, you know, something, because they just weren't supposed to eat anything basically. That's how he ensnared them, and he would talk to them about their personal lives and, you know, did they have a crush on any of the male?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Gymnasts, and, you know, looking back, they both said, too, gosh, you know, as adults, they realized that for an adult man to be that involved in a young girl's life and personal life, of course, is a major red flag. But, again, they were very isolated gymnasts. They were embroiled in training. A lot of the young women told me they didn't, you know, abuse was not on their radar. You know, it just wasn't, their parents thought they were safe in gymnastics world. They were always training. So abuse wasn't, it just wasn't part of their universe. And also they had never dated, even through high school, they didn't date because they were, you know, spending all of their free time at the gym. And so, you know, a lot of them told me they had never even held a boy's hand. But, you know, so they were very vulnerable.
Yeah.
Kids.
Did they ever talk amongst themselves or talk about Larry to, you know, each other, like that what he was doing, or question anything?
Yes, that's a really good question, because, and this was very interesting to me too, some of them didn't talk about it, but some of them did. And there was, I remember one young woman told me she had, when he first abused her, she suspected it was abuse. And she had grown up in that boot camp gym, but she had left it for her high school gymnastics team because it was just too insane. So she was a little bit out of the, you know, the kind of brainwashing zone, as the women described it. And she could recognize that that might have been abuse. And afterwards, she went to her friends and said, "Does he do that to you? What was that?" And she said her friends said, "Oh, he does that to everyone." And she thought, "Oh, well, then it must be okay, because she wasn't, he wasn't singling her out. He wasn't targeting her." And so oddly, you know, the fact that he did it to so many girls ended up helping to protect him, because they would think, well, he does it to everyone. Another gymnast, a three-time national champion gymnast, told me when he first abused her, it was at the Caroli Ranch. And she wasn't, you know, she wasn't sure if it was or wasn't abused. She just had a very dark feeling about it, and she refused to see him on her final night. And she said one of the other gymnasts there said something like, "Yeah, he touches you funny." So, you know, the fact that he did it to, you know, so many of them, I think if they did talk about it with each other, that kind of helped them rationalize that, well, no, it couldn't be, he wouldn't be doing something wrong, you know, he's not targeting me. And that's a reminder how kids think, you know. We look at kids as adults and think, well, how, you know, why wouldn't you know, or why wouldn't you say? Well, we're not thinking like kids. You know, a lot of these are young kids and their brains aren't fully developed, and they were vulnerable in so many ways. And here was the Olympic doctor. We're taught to trust doctors, and he was this huge, big, important doctor. But, you know, that young woman who had gone to her friends and said, "Do you think it's abuse?" It killed me, because she said she looks back and she's so mad at herself, because, you know, because she feels like, "I knew, I didn't trust myself, and I knew." And I told her, and I told so many people, because I heard this time and again, that they look back and question themselves. The kids, the parents, everyone looked back and questioned themselves or blamed themselves. And that killed me, because the blame is on the predator, you know, and his enablers. That's who to blame. But I could see that this is what predators do to people. They make them look back and blame themselves. But again, that's why all these women shared these stories, because they want to help other people recognize how predators work. And so, you know, to prevent this in the future, so other families don't have to go through it.
Mm. Well, you talked about the institutionalism of all this, how the fact that there were so many different girls molested kind of lent itself to the idea that it's normal, and so did all these other people who looked the other way. So I have to ask you, obviously one of the parallels to this would be the Jerry Sandusky case at Penn State University, where it appeared to be going on for years and people looked the other way. How prevalent do you think this is across America?
I have a feeling we're going to be hearing about a lot more cases like this. You know, some other more cases have come out about doctors around the country. You know, I think there's so much to be learned from this. And again, that's why I'm so glad these women shared these personal stories, because they've shown how this happens. And, you know, I think they really help people understand, you know, whether kids or adults are reading this book, it helps them see, trust your instincts, trust your gut, because, you know, a lot of these girls, or some of these girls did, even if they weren't sure if it was abuse or not, they let themselves be talked out of it. And I think there's such a powerful lesson in that. And also to the parents, to coaches, to administrators, you know, listen to what students, athletes, listen to what kids are telling you, because, you know, they weren't all evil and diabolical trying to protect a predator. They just weren't listening. They weren't paying attention. They just assumed that he was the doctor and this was a kid. So, the doctor knows what he's doing, and the kid has misunderstood. So there are just so many powerful lessons in this, you know, across the spectrum.
I found in the book, I think one of the most important parts for people to try and understand is there were quite a few girls that, even when the story of Larry Nassar assaulting kids came out, and they were asked, because they were trained by him or trained in the same gym, and he doctored them, and they actually said no, and they denied it, and they denied it strongly, and it took them a long time before they actually would turn their story around. And one point, Judge Kavanaugh was up for his, you know, becoming a Supreme, and that whole sexual assault thing came out. And because of the way that happened, I think a lot of the girls were scared. So I think there's this part of them that they're into denial of some sort.
Yeah, well, this was so interesting that it goes to show just how good this man became at being a predator. I mean, he was such a master. These women thought he was their friend. You know, they had grown up with him. They thought he was their friend for life. Their families knew him. You know, I remember Lindsay Lemke's mom told me she bought him gift certificates to take his kids to dinner because she was worried that he was spending so much time helping Lindsay that he wasn't spending enough time with his own family. These families thought he was their friend, and these young women, yes, a number of them who I talked to in the beginning when the allegations first came out, they didn't believe them, or they didn't want to believe them. They just wanted to believe it was a medical treatment. You know, even the young woman who had reported him in 1997 to the coach at Michigan State, she said when the allegations first came out, she didn't want to believe them because it meant she was right. It meant she was right all those years ago, decades ago, and that she could have stopped him. Now, she was a kid. She did everything she could. She reported him to the coach at Michigan State. But, you know, even for her, it was hard to wrap her head around the idea that he was a predator. So, yeah, so a lot of the women, they just, you know, they couldn't see this man, this friend, this nice, a lot of them described him as this nice, nerdy guy. You know, you think of a predator, you see Law and Order, you hear the scary music, you know the predator is coming. Here's this nice, nerdy, sweet guy, this friend, this guy who was always there to listen, always texting, bringing gifts, you know, spending all this time. He even, you know, people trusted him so deeply, he manipulated people into bringing their kids to his house, where he abused the kids in the basement because he set up a makeshift clinic in his basement. So with his family there, you know, family upstairs, him downstairs, abusing kids on this, you know, in this little clinic he had set up. You know, and again, the families felt like, well, he's the Olympic doctor, and how amazing that he's making time for us, you know. So, yeah, so it was hard for people to accept that this nice guy was a sexual predator, and that it was not, he was not giving the medical treatment. It was abuse. And, you know, what helped some of the women, well, I'm not sure if helped is the right word, but what made them accept that he was a predator for a lot of them was the fact that he got caught with all that child pornography. You know,
that, yeah, I have to ask you about that. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that is,
oh, no problem.
You know, he tried to play it off as just inappropriate touching or other things, but they found something like, what, 35,000 child pornography images and videos. So it's not like this guy was just, you know, a nice guy who crossed the line sometimes. He was a prolific sexual predator for decades.
Yes, and he was a manipulator. And even after he pleaded guilty, he wrote a letter to the judge saying he had only pleaded guilty because he wanted to spare his family and the community the pain of a trial. So he was still, after he pleaded guilty, claiming he was, you know, a good doctor. That's what he said in his letter. He was a good doctor. And he said the women were just mad because the media had made them believe that that he had done something wrong. And he said, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. You know, so he was just constantly manipulating. A perfect example of his manipulations was there was a young woman named Kyle Stevens. She was 6 years old, and she was a neighbor, a family friend. And he started abusing her when she was a kid in the basement. And he wasn't pretending to give any medical treatment. He was just outright abusing her. And when she was 12, she realized what was going on. She realized it was abuse because she read about the Catholic priest scandal, and a friend told her she had been abused. And she started to realize, oh my God, this neighbor, this friend, this doctor, what he was doing was abuse. And she told her parents, and she told her parents some of what he was doing. And they, he went over to her house, and he sat down with her and her parents, and he told the girl, she discussed this in her, victim impact statement in court. He told her, obviously I didn't do that, but if someone did abuse you, you should tell someone. And he said, if this does happen to you, you should tell someone. This is a 12-year-old girl, and, what a mind game. He's telling her, if someone does abuse you that way, you should tell someone. Someone was abusing her that way, and she was telling someone, yeah. And it was him. So it just goes to show, the manipulations, the lengths he was willing to go to.
Well, and then last year, it says here, I'm reading some thing off Wikipedia here, where it says that he was trying to get a new sentencing hearing because he's claiming that the judge was biased against him, as if that was the problem. It wasn't the hundreds
yes.
of victims and child pornography. It was bias. That's just yes. stunningly
and,
out of touch.
I mean, I know. And I talked to the judge about that, Judge Aquilina, who's fantastic. She's the one who let, more than 150 women stand up in court, give their victim impact statements. And that's when you saw that phenomenal week of, all these women standing up. And she spoke to each one of them individually after they stood up. It was just, an absolutely cathartic scene. And, but yes, afterward, his attorneys, he accused her of bias. And, she points out that actually, before Nassar pleaded guilty, to be fair, she had put a gag order on all the women. She had made all the women mad because she had put a gag order on them. And so they couldn't speak to the press, to be fair to him. And, she said, I guess, he their side forgot about that. But in the beginning, all the women were mad at her. But after he pleaded guilty, and it was part of his plea agreement that that women who had accused him of sexual abuse could have the opportunity to make a statement in court. That was part of his plea deal. I just don't think he imagined how many would be doing that. And also, as women began standing up, other women who had been part of the case felt empowered that they could too. So the number kept growing. But yes, I mean, it just goes to show his, never-ending tactics to try to manipulate and blame
and
others.
He's so disconnected. It kind of reminds me of when Ted Bundy was days away from being executed, and the governor was refusing to give him a stay of execution, and all this. Ted Bundy actually said something like, "I don't understand why everybody's out to get me."
Oh my
it's
gosh!
Like,
yeah,
you're not in prison because a judge was biased against you.
Exactly.
It's like, that's not what's going on.
Oh my
on
god!
Here.
Yeah. Right.
And now nobody else got charged in any of this abuse, like TriStars or John Goddard, the coach. None of those people got convicted of anything, right?
Well, there's a number of people have been fired, and some have been arrested. One of them is going to jail. People have been fired from Michigan State, from USA Gymnastics, from the U.S. Olympic Committee, several have been arrested from Michigan State and from USA Gymnastics. And, for instance, the Michigan State coach, the president, and Nassar's boss, the dean of the osteopathic school at Michigan State, they were all arrested and charged. The coach and the president are still in the court system. The dean was found guilty of, he had failed to supervise Nassar, and he is going to jail. But the coach, the coach at TwiStars Gym in Michigan, John Geddes, the one who so many of the women told me created that abusive training environment, they said, they really want to see him held accountable. And he was suspended by USA Gymnastics after the Nassar sentencing hearings, because a lot of the women stood up and started talking about what he had done in court. So he was suspended, and then he retired, and the Michigan police launched an investigation, and now the Michigan Attorney General has taken over that investigation of him. But it's been going on for more than a year and a half, and, you know, the women, they want to see him held accountable. You know, there was another woman who told her story for the first time in this book about how she says Gettert, the coach, started grooming her when she was 16, a gymnast at his gym, and that when she left his gym at 18 for college, he initiated a sexual relationship. And she said she was one of those kids who had grown up in gymnastics. She had never dated anyone. This was her first love, her first everything. She thought he was going to marry her, and he ended up discarding her and leaving her suicidal. And also, his actions violate the code of conduct of the Olympic watchdog safe sport, you know, a coach-athlete relationship like that, even though she had left his gym and even though she was 18, it violates the code of conduct because there's a power imbalance there. And it, you know, in her case, it left her, you know, almost killing herself. And she told her story to help people understand about grooming, you know, about how this gymnastics environment on so many levels can be harmful. And, you know, again, it's all part of this story. This coach who went on to become Olympic coach and worked with Nassar for almost 30 years and is under investigation, but has yet to be held accountable. So it'll be very interesting to see what shakes out there.
Are there any civil actions or lawsuits against anyone or the universities involved? Or?
Yeah, so there was, Michigan State University, USA Gymnastics, U.S. Olympic Committee, TwistArts, yeah, there are civil suits against all of them. And the Michigan State, a very interesting story came out a lawyer told me a very interesting story for my book about Michigan State, because MSU ended up settling for $500 million with the survivors. And, you know, these women need this money because so many of them who I talk to are suffering from terrible injuries today because they were not treated as children, because their so-called doctor, Nassar, wasn't treating them, and because they were afraid to even tell if they had injuries, you know, the gymnasts at the gym, because they would get in trouble. So now they have a lot of medical bills and a lot of therapy bills, too, as they're coming to grips with the fact that their trusted childhood doctor had sexually abused them. So, you know, really use this money. And there's an attorney named Jamie White, who I spoke with for the book, and he told me something so interesting about that settlement. He said when the case first began, there basically was no civil case because so many of the women were outside the statute of limitations, for one thing. And separately, Michigan State had immunity as a state, as a government institution. So, you know, it looked pretty impossible for anything to happen for most of these women. Well, Jamie got to work behind the scenes with a state senator on two bills, one to expand the statute of limitations and the second to strip the university of its legal immunity. And he was so smart, he kept tabs on the lawmakers. He, you know, kept track of which way the vote was going to go. And he realized the bill to expand the statute of limitations was going to pass, but the bill stripping the university of its immunity was not going to pass. There was pushback on that, you know, like from a lot of different forces. In fact, you know, same with the statute of limitations, you know, the Catholic Church was pushing back on expanding that, you know, because they don't want to be sued for priest abuse going back decades. So anyway, but it looked like the statute of limitations bill would pass. But the bill stripping the university of immunity would not. So Jamie found that out. He got on the horn with his band of lawyers, because there were lawyers across the country representing this growing number of women, and said, make the deal now, because he said Michigan State doesn't know yet that it's going to keep its immunity. And they made the deal for $500 million. And the university might have, you know, would have, could have paid nothing.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Now, what do you want people to get out of the book?
Well, I really want them to read it and understand how predators operate, how they prey on not just the kids, but the entire family, the parents, the community, the grandparents, you know, that how predators prey and how to stop them in the future. I mean, that's what these stories do. I spoke to 25 survivors of Nassar's abuse, spanning almost 30 years from the very first known survivor to the very last. The first survivor is in her mid-40s now. The last is in her mid-teens. And it just goes to show that the range of the abuse. And they unveil decade by decade by decade how he honed his skills. So there is so much to learn from these stories, because like I said, these are the girls who grew up with him. These people, they knew him well and they saw it all. And there's incredible power in their stories. I mean, they basically took the power back from this predator and now they're sharing it with other people. So I hope people read this book and see how it happened and how we can prevent it from happening again. And also just the courage and the strength of these women to tell these deeply personal stories. It's incredible, the fact that they were willing to do that to help other people, because when you tell a story like that, you're putting yourself out there, like we talked about at the top of the segment, you're putting yourself out there in so many ways. You're exposing yourself, people know something deeply personal about you from a Google search. And they know, before you go to a job interview, the boss knows something about you. Before you go on a first date, that person knows something about you. And it's your most personal, experience, most personal, painful experience imaginable. And they know that about you before you even meet them. You don't get a chance to tell them. They already know it if they've Googled you. And everyone's Googling everyone, so everyone knows.
And everyone said stuff.
And some of these women are parents now themselves. And so when they go public with their story, they have to figure out how and when to tell their kids, because their kids are inevitably going to find the details online, So it takes so much courage to come forward with a story like this, but it's how things change, and it empowers other people to do the same. The very last Nassar survivor, a young woman named Emma Ann Miller, she was a 15-year-old girl, and, when I spoke to her, she said that when she stood up in court and gave her statement to Nassar, that next week at school, in high school, one of her classmates pulled her aside and took her into the bathroom and said she was being abused by a relative and she had never told anyone. And she saw Emma Ann stand up in court and she was telling Emma Ann. And it just gave me a chill, because Emma Ann said, "You can tell someone, you can tell your mom." And the girl did. And right there, you see the power of telling these personal stories and how it helps other people figure out what's happening to them, or figure out how to tell what's happening to them and see that they can, that they have the strength to do that. Mm-hmm. So that was a long answer to your question, but those are the reasons why I really hope people read this book.
Well, there's
so much power in it.
It's a really good book. I listened to it a few times, and I recommend it. And we're going to have your website and the book posted on our website, so people can, when they're listening, they can do one click, pick up the book. I recommend it. The audiobook is read really well, too. You have a really good person that reads the book. I really like that.
Thank you so much. Oh. Yeah, she did a great job.
Yeah, really good. The book is called The Girls. It's an all-American town, a predatory doctor, and the untold story of the gymnasts who brought him down. And that guest is the author, Abigail Pesta. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for spreading the word about these brave women. I so appreciate it.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.